Rabbim, welcome everyone to the third in a series of shiurim on dealing with your teenage children. Until now we spoke about assessing the problem and why nowadays there's more of a difficulty in raising children than there was in the past. We're going to speak more about that in a moment because it catches us off guard. The second shiur we spoke about instilling self-esteem in a child and how we're supposed to train a child to react to his own imperfection. This one, this evening, we're going to learn how to be a role model for your children. And contrary to popular belief, it's not enough just to play the role. While it's true that the do as I see and not as I do parent has no chance of bringing up a normal, healthy child, it's not good enough just to do what you want your child to do. There's a lot more to it than that. And this we get from a Gemara. The Gemara tells us a story about a child that went off the derech in ancient times. The child's name was Elisha, and he was destined to become a very big Gadol Hador. He learned Torah from Rabbi Meir, who was one of the great Tanoim of his days. This Elisha, who was supposed to be such a great Talmud Chacham, ended up driving a horse on Yom Kippur that came out on Shabbos right by the Beis HaMikdash, by the Kodesh HaKadoshim. You can't get much worse than that. It was Yom Kippur and Shabbos and Yerushalayim and the Beis HaMikdash and the Kodesh HaKadoshim, and he rode his horse. A bus coil came out because this Mechalel Shabbos was still on the Madrega to hear a bas koil. And that shows you what level of tumah there had to be in him in order to rip him away from that level of Kedusha. And the tumah and the Kedusha was still struggling within him. And the bas koil said, Shuvu banim shayvavim. It said, return my backsliding children. Chutz mi Elisha. Except for Elisha. The bas koil rejected his tshuva, and it told him, we don't want you anymore. Now, why exactly the bas koil was justified in throwing up a wall between Elisha and his tshuva is not for tonight. How we reconcile this with the Chazal that tell us Ein lecha davar ha'imid b'fnei ha'tshuva, that there's nothing that stands in the way of tshuva, is not this evening's topic. But the point is that this great man went very, very far off the derech, and it behooves us to try to understand what would schlep such a high level personality, a man that hears bus coils even as he's being machal el Shabbos. What would pull him so far away from that level that he was destined to be on? What is so powerful in the world? What koyach hatuma is so powerful to schlep somebody off the derech so far? And we can imagine that if it schleps Elisha off the derech, it could wreak havoc with any of our children. Rachmona litzlan. Now the Gemara contradicts itself on this. There's a seeming stira in the Gemara as to why Elisha went off the derech. One Gemara tells us that it's his father's fault. His father, a man by the name of Abuya, was also on a relatively high madrega, such that when he saw at Elisha's bris the Talmidei Chachamim learning Torah, and he was able to sense the Malachim learning, and the Kailos to Brokim, and he saw Zvorm Smechim Kinesinos on Misinai, and we understand that if Abuya was on the level to see Zvorm Smechim Kinesinos on Misinai, he was not a simple person. We are not dealing with simple people over here. We are dealing with people on very, very high madregas. And this Elish, this Abuya, this father of this 8-day-old child Elisha, decided right then and there to dedicate his son, his newborn 8-day-old Elisha, to Torah for the rest of his life. And he said, if this is the glory that Torah brings, this Dvorm Smechem Kinesinos on Misinai, if this is how magnificent Torah is, and he was able to sense on his high madrega all the great magnificence of Torah, then I am going to dedicate my child to it for the rest of his life. And on that day, he decided that this little baby is going to grow up to be a big goyin and tzaddik in Gadol Hador. Now, we may think that Elisha's resolution, that Abuya's resolution then and there was a very meritorious one, and that he gets credit in a big yashikoyah for dedicating his child to Torah. But the Gemara says no, and it's because more was expected of this man Abuya. The problem was that you should not need to see glory and magnificence to dedicate your child to Torah. Abuya was dedicating his son to Torah for shaloi lishma reasons. If he wouldn't have seen those glory, if he wouldn't have seen the fireworks, he would not have dedicated his son to Torah? The answer is he wouldn't have. And therefore, if it's only fireworks that Abuya was interested in, it was a punishment for him, says the Chazal, that his son is not going to reach that level that he aspired to for him. And therefore, Elisha went off the derech. That's one Chazal, that because of his father's attitude, it was a punishment and Elisha went off. Then there's another Chazal that has a totally different picture of why Elisha went off the derech. And this Chazal tells us a story about the Asara Haruge Malchus, those 10 Gedolei Hador that were murdered torturously by the Romans in the days of the destruction of the second Beis HaMikdash, and that Tekufa. And one of these Asara Haruge Malchus, one of these tzaddikim, was named Chutzpis HaMeturgeman. He was the interpreter for the Talmidei Chachamim in the Beis HaMedrash. And Elisha saw the tongue of Chutzpis HaMeturgeman being dragged by a pig in the dirt. And Elisha said that if this great tongue that said so much Torah, and remember this was the interpreter, his whole Torah was done with his mouth, if this tongue that said, that spewed forth such pearls of wisdom, such Torah, is dragged through the floor, I'm not interested in the whole kit and caboodle. And he chopped Yiddishkeit Elisha, and he became the Mechal Shabbos that we know of. Now these are two stories, and one has nothing to do with the other. And so which one is it? Was it some punishment for Elisha's father? Because Elisha's father was on that high madrega that he was supposed to learn Torah Lishma. Or was it the disillusionment of Elisha himself when he saw the tongue of a tzaddik being dragged in the dirt? There are a lot of answers to this contradiction given in the Meforshim, but this evening I'm going to stick as much to the pashtus, to the simple meaning as possible. And there is a very simple explanation to this, that the two Gemaras, the two Chazals, do not contradict each other, but rather they are one and the same. When we speak about being a role model for our children, the first lesson is that it's not good enough to just model that role that you want your children to grow up into. You have to really sincerely believe in it. And your attitude has to be proper, not only your actions. In other words, those parents who hide the television in their bedroom closet so that the children shouldn't see it, and maybe the children will never see it, but it doesn't help. Because children are so good at sniffing out the attitudes of their parents, the real mohus, the real essence of what mommy and tati really are, that if, even if they never see that television stuck in that bedroom closet, they're going to be affected by that television as if they knew loud and clear that it was there. Therefore, Elisha the Tzaddik, Elisha the Talmud of Rebbe Meir, Elisha the supposed to be Tana of our Mishnah, went off the derech because he saw a Tzaddik v'Ravoi, because he saw the tongue of a Talmud Chacham being dragged along in the dirt. This is Tzaddik V'Ra'aloi. This is one of the oldest questions in the book, and we know that whatever the answers are, we are smart enough and bright enough and astute enough to know that it's no problem. It may be a terrible tragedy, and it may be something that we cry over, and it may be something that we sit on Tisha B'Av on the floor and weep over, part of the results of the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash, but we know that it's nothing to become Mechal Shabbos because of. We look askance at those that came out of Khurban Europe, out of World War II, and shocked Yiddishkeit because of the horrors that they see, and it's very difficult to put yourself in their place, and al todin es chavercha achi tigia b'mkaymai. But we know that from an objective standpoint, there is nothing in the world in Tzaddik V'Ra'aloi to cause somebody to throw Yiddishkeit off. And yet, this is what happened to Elisha. Elisha, who learns Torah from Reb Meir, how do we understand this? That such a great personality fell victim to something that we ourselves are hopefully immune to? The answer is that with a father, Rabbi Zai, like Abuya, that's what could be expected from him. Abuya was a man who dedicated Elisha to Torah for one reason and one reason only. And that's because Abuya saw the glory and the magnificence that Torah brings. Abuya valued Torah only because of the fireworks that it causes. And that attitude, that treifa attitude that Abuya had, was inherited by Elisha. Abuya never told Elisha only to learn Torah because of glory. But that was Abuya's attitude. And if that was Abuya's attitude, that became Elisha's attitude, perhaps more so, more intensely, and with a greater severity, and became a greater weakness than Abuya ever imagined. And so, if glory and magnificence and fireworks is your main and your only motive for learning Torah, then what do you expect to happen to that man, that Elisha, when he sees the tongue of a tzaddik being dragged in the dirt, where fireworks was supposed to be there, where fireworks was his motivation? He saw disgrace. And because he saw disgrace, and he had a father to whom Torah meant only fireworks, he was vulnerable where we are not, to seeing such a tragedy and becoming the victim of the Yetzer Hara and throwing off Yiddishkeit. So again, Elisha went off the derech. He threw off Yiddishkeit because his father had a wrong attitude that Elisha inherited, that created a weakness within him that made him susceptible to this Yetzer Hara. And we have no contradiction anymore, ladies and gentlemen. They are both true. Elisha went off the derech because of one reason, and the Chazal just give us two halves of the story in two different places. If we want to make ourselves role models for our children, it's not good enough just to do what we want them to do. Although without that we stand no chance. We have to believe in it and sacrifice for it and hold from it the way we want our children to. And you think it's an easy thing. The classic example, the most simple example, the most extreme example, and the most absurd example is the parent that keeps the television in the closet. But we have a heart besides a closet. that we sometimes keep other things, things other than televisions within there. We tell our children, go to yeshiva and listen to your Rebbe. Yeah? Every parent has a Rebbe, and if not a Rebbe, you go to shul on Shabbos, you have a Rav. And the Rav gets up and he says, a drasha, how terrible it is to talk in shul. And your son may see you talking in shul when the Rav isn't watching, or he may not. But even if he does not, he'll smell it in you. He'll smell that imperfection. And forget about the talking in shul. It's the insubordination of listening to authority that he's going to pick up. If you don't listen to your Rav, you can't expect your child to listen to his Rebbe. And if he comes home with a slip of paper from school and a Rebbe said he was chutzpahdik today, what can you expect? If you come home on the Shabbos table and said the Rav said this drasha, ah, Baba Mises. What can you expect? And even if you don't say it, if that's what you think, your child will sniff it out. I'm sure you've heard many times about the hypocritical parents that expect their children to be better than them. We know that doesn't work. Today we're saying that that's not enough. It's not enough not to be hypocritical. Because what hypocritical means is that don't let your actions contradict your commands that you give to your son. But your actions aren't all that has to contradict it. It's what's going on in your heart. Because, Rabbi Sai, we communicate with our children mostly with our heart. 70% of communication is with the heart. 30% is with words. You know, if you know the old story with the president and the rabbi and the shul got into a fight, and the president of the shul says this comment about the rabbi, and he says, Rabbi, you're a mamzer. And the people in the shul make the president make a public apology, and they know that this president is a shrewd guy. And if he gets up and makes a public apology, it will be mixed in with the public apology will be some other things. And they don't want this guy to get up and have the pulpit for himself. So what the shul does is they give him a paper with a written out speech, and they tell him, say these words. And on the paper it says, I said the rabbi is a mamzer and I was wrong. And they wrote that out, and they said, you just say these words? And that's it. And he gets up to the president and he says, I said the rabbi's a mamzer. And I was wrong? And he said the exact words of what was on the paper. But it's the tone of voice that counts. And it's the body language that counts. And if you come to your child and you try to make believe you're not angry, he'll know if you're angry. And your child will know what you really think of your Rav and your Shul. And your child will know what you think of Hashem. And your child will know how dedicated you are to Yiddishkeit. And your child will know everything about you that he needs to know to get his lesson from his role model. And if it's not there, listen, an act is better than overt apikursis in the home. However, he's going to smell it out. It's the attitude in the home that counts more than anything else. Because we communicate with our children, and our children share such a bond with us, such a close bond that transcends words and it transcends actions. It's a heart-to-heart bond that Dvarim HaYotzim Min HaLev goes straight Nichnasim El HaLev. And you can't hide from your children. It's nature. It's the way HaKadosh Baruch Hu made it. And Elisha's father couldn't hide from him. Elisha's father had an attitude, and Elisha became a Mechal Shabbos because of that. There are so many... Very often, and we're going to start with concrete examples. We're going to start Poshet Bein Odom L'Chaveroi, of an example how we sometimes harbor an attitude in our hearts And although our words may say otherwise, our children automatically pick it up. And this is the most overt thing and the most common thing that I could think of. And this is something that I once told somebody who wanted to open up an organization, or really open up a branch of his organization that he has, a chinuch organization, to deal with children that are going off the derech. And he calls me to his office, this man, and he says, "Okay, Rabbi Shapiro, let's talk. What are we going to do?" So, what happens? This man has a bunch of social workers on his staff. And there was this kid, we'll call him Brian, for lack of a better name, who I wanted to meet, and who his social workers wanted to meet. Now, they got to him first. Somewhere in Greenwich Village, they found him and picked him up. That's very good. And this Brian, he knew about me. And this social worker asks Brian, "Can I give Rabbi Shapiro your telephone number?" And he says, "Sure." So social worker picks out of his pocket a piece of paper that says, "I give blank," and he filled in Rabbi Shapiro, "permission, I give so-and-so, the social worker, permission to give Rabbi Shapiro my telephone number. Signed, Brian, so-and-so." And he asks this kid to sign it. Now this kid looks at him like he just dropped from another planet. Like he's from somewhere out of the Milky Way galaxy. This is a kid, maybe he knows how to sign his name. But this street kid is interested in this contract. It just doesn't go. And I told this man, I said, this got back to me. I said, "You can't do this with these kids. You know why? Because you come to them, you try to help them. And you tell them, 'Brian, I believe in you. You could be something,' and all that self-esteem stuff that social workers always talk about. But over here, you make him sign a paper as if he's a hardened criminal, as if he needs this extra supervision for something so simple like giving his phone number out to somebody. What are you telling him? You're telling him, 'Brian, you are a case. You are file number 365 in my file cabinet.' You tell him, 'Brian, I believe in you.' That's what your words say. And you say you have self-esteem and you can grow to be good and you're really not so bad and don't believe what people say to you. And you're saying to him with your body and with your actions and with all the honesty in the heart that you can muster, 'Brian, you are a dangerous creature.' And that doesn't work. And he tells me, this man, he says, 'Well, he has to understand this, Brian, that we're doing this for his own protection.' And I said, 'My friend, that's a straitjacket you put on somebody for his own protection as well. But when you do that, you're giving him a message. And when you give me your friend Moshe's phone number, you don't make him sign a paper, but you're making this kid sign a paper. And what does that show you? And what does that show the kid? Forget it. It'll never work. The whole mahalach,' I told him. Parents do this a lot. They suspect, let's say, the kid wasn't in school today. Somebody calls up, gives the parents some piece of information, and the parent suspects the child wasn't in school. Or the parent suspects the child did something, whatever, that he wasn't supposed to do. So parent asks child, 'Where were you today?' And child says, 'What do you care?' And parent says, 'I'm just asking.' Those three words, 'I'm just asking,' are trait. Get them out of your vocabulary unless you plan on being more honest with your son. And say, 'I suspect, I think that this is what you did,' or, 'Somebody called me and said this is what you did. I want to hear your side of the story, because this is dishonest. Nobody just asks. You know the old question? Do you still beat your wife? Yes or no? I'm just asking. I'm just asking. There's no such thing as just asking. just asking is something that parents use to camouflage their real suspicions. And if you do suspect your child, he's going to smell it. If you don't, he won't. But don't be dishonest with him. You don't have to be accusatory, and you don't have to tell him, I think you did this, but be honest with him. Tell him. Somebody put a seed of doubt in your mind. Tell him, look, Moshele, I don't believe it. I don't want to believe it. Somebody called me. Tell me, what's going on? I'm just asking is a lie. And you are not just asking. You are probing. You are investigating. You are not just asking. And children get annoyed at that. And inside, it gives them the message that my parents aren't open with me and they suspect, and this is subconscious. They pick it up and they know. There are many more examples of this. But rather than give you words to knock out of your vocabulary, I'll give you the formula that will prevent you from being dishonest in this way with your children. Shainu Shamayim Rabbosai. Your children are sitting there dying to know how you feel about them. Dying to know how you feel in general. They look to their parents and they say, how does my father or how does my mother, an adult, my father, my mother, feel, respond, react to this that happens? Tell them. If you're hurt, tell them, look, I'm hurt. If you believe something other than what you want to believe, tell them. Figure out what you are feeling. Rachel Bitcha HaKetana. And tell them straight. If you did something wrong to them, there are so many parents that rather than asking Mechila from their children, they'll shove it under the rug. Because they feel that if they ask, it's below them, it's not covered for parents. It's not covered at Torah, it's not covered of Kibbur Ava'ein, but you know, there's a shaila in the Rambam, in the Sefer Tshuvas HaRambam, where a Rebbe made some comments about Muslims or Arabs or something, and if I remember it correctly, I may be a little off, I haven't seen it in a while, there was a ger in the class that came from the Muslims or the Arabs or something like that, but whatever it was, the Rebbe accidentally offended one of the children and hurt him. And the shaila that came to the Rambam is, does this Rebbe have to ask Mechila? Does a Rebbe have to ask Mechila? It's in Shalos HaTshuvos HaRambam. And the Rambam says, of course! Of course a Rebbe has to ask Mechila to a Talmud if he does something wrong. Why not? But the Rambam was talking from a halacha, which is true. You're chayiv to do it. But practically speaking, you gotta be a shaitan not to. Because you don't treat your child properly, he's gonna be moira hetan not to treat anybody properly. If you treat your child with respect, he will grow up to be a respectful person. If you treat your child with dignity, he will grow up to be a dignified person. If you treat your child with trust, he will grow up to be a trustworthy person. If you treat your child with love, he will grow up to be a loving person. Ask your children's opinions on things. You don't have to ask him about where to invest your money. That's not his business where you invest your money. But if there's some dilemma that you're in, something that it's not a problem for him to know. Tell him, I have something on my mind. This is what it is. Show him you respect what he has to say. You don't have to listen to him. But show him you respect what he has to say. Open up to him, and I promise you, Rabbosai, he will open up to you. Show him that you're a human being too. Sometimes you're you're confused. And if you're confused and you don't know what to do, you know what you do? You go ask somebody. You shoyl etza by your Rebbe. Or you go ask a Rebbe, or whoever you ask when you're in a dilemma. And let your child know that. Teach him that when you have a problem in life, you go to inquire in Das Torah. And if you teach him that, he will. In order to do that, though, you have to open up to him and show him that you're not a Malach Hashem Tzevachos, that you're not God, that you are a human being, and you sometimes have to have dilemmas as well. And there's nothing wrong with that. There is nothing wrong with that at all. It's something that parents are reluctant to do, and again, what it's not his business is not his business. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about showing your child your true colors, unless you're ashamed of them. And then we know what the root of the problem is. So many parents come to me and, Rabbi Shapiro, what do I do? What's wrong with my home? And after speaking to the parents a number of times, and I get to see their attitudes, I'm not only talking about Bein Odom L'Mokom, Bein Odom L'Chaveroi, the way that they deal with people, the way they think of themselves. It's no wonder that the children are messed up. And you know what? Such silly little things, a silly little, one little imperfection in a home can have devastating consequences, can wreak havoc on the attitude of a child. A home is such a delicate balance nowadays. It always used to be. But nowadays we are beset and attacked by outside forces beyond comprehension. And the balance that we have to have in the home has that delicacy and that balance of a great complicated computer. You go in, you snip a wire. You accidentally pour a small cup of coffee over your computer. A silly little cup of coffee. You accidentally get some dust in the wrong place. And all of a sudden the screen goes for a piece of dust. Our homes are delicately balanced, just like that computer. A little piece of dust, a little attitude problem. It sinks in, it goes to the kishkes. If the parents are overtly imperfect, so that's outside. But if they're covertly imperfect, and it gets hidden in the child's heart and his psyche as well. And it doesn't come out until later. And then Rachmana Litzlan, it's that much more difficult to deal with because it's been growing and festering in the child's mind and his heart for all those years. Another attitude that we sometimes have vis-a-vis our children that's perhaps a little more innocent than the I'm just asking syndrome is this one. In a world where Baruch Hashem we have kosher food, you can work and be a Shomer Shabbos, and if your boss doesn't want you to be a Shomer Shabbos, you can go to court. We have yeshivas, we have tapes, and we have daf yomis, and we have Rambam Shirim, and you can listen in the car to Torah. We live in a Torah world. And we're so proud of ourselves because 40 years ago, this wasn't here. We grew up and our parents worked 6 days and on the seventh day they got fired. And they had to find another job if they wanted to keep Shabbos. And if you wanted kosher food for Pesach, you had to sit in the kitchen and make it yourself. They didn't have Bodek vegetables that you can get. Freeze-dried, action-packed, kosher food, TV dinners, open it up, and there you are. It was rough, it was hard. We planted Torah in America, and now we are in a Torah greenhouse. We fought the wars, and we won. And we went through the battles, and we came out. And now the attitude we have towards our children is, children, we worked and we did all this for you. It's Shulchan Aruch Lefanecha. It's easy for you. For us it was hard. For you it's easy. and we may keep telling them stories about our parents and when we were growing up and how hard it was, and we say, Baruch Hashem, you should thank the Rabbeinu Shalom, throw your hands up to the Shemayim and say, Hallelujah, that you are living in 1994 and not in 1944, 1954 in America. And this is very nice, but you know what kind of pressure it puts on kids? We all know that there's a special pressure that's felt by children of Rosh Hashivas and Rabbanim because there are different expectations of them. I have a friend, Baruch Hashem, very fine young man, he's learning in Kollel. His name is Aaron Kotler. Rav Shneur's son. Now, imagine, kid grows up, he goes to camp, some guy sees him on a basketball court and he asks him, what's your name? He says, my name is Aaron Kotler. Immediately, you know who his father is, you know how old he is, you immediately know what family comes from, and immediately the expectations come in. It's tough. We sometimes inadvertently throw that pressure on our children when we tell them that it's easy for them, much easier than it was for us. We give them expectations. And you know what? We brought Yiddishkeit in America so high that our children's generation has no place else to bring it but down. We fought the wars, they don't fight anything. We fought the wars and they say, look, if you're from in today's America, fine. No problem, no time, if that's what you're supposed to be, it's so easy. And if you're not, then you're a bum. In the olden days, you see, when I was a kid, you tell your kids, if you were from, you're a tzaddik. And if you weren't from, we understand. You're handicapping them with this pressure right away. And the truth is, it's a sheker. Because nowadays, it's much more hard to grow up as a kid. Forget about having a job. These kids don't have jobs. These kids aren't spalabatim. These are children. To be a teenager now in America, there is much more subtle tumor out there. It's much more difficult than we could ever imagine. We should tell our children, children, I envy your chelik in Olam Haba. Because when you walk home from yeshiva every day, the nisyonis that you encounter on the way from yeshiva to home is more than I ever encountered my whole life in America. Why shouldn't we give them credit where credit is due? And credit is due. And these children are growing up and they tell me this. Sometimes they tell it to me straight and sometimes they tell it to me under a hypnotic trance. But they say it one way or the other, they reveal it. They don't get credit for what they have accomplished. And I'm not talking about when you hear in all the shiurim, tell your kid, oh, job well done, oh, I'm proud of you. This is also true. But I'm talking one step further. I'm talking about the credit that they get for being a frum a yid, growing up, being a ben Torah today in America. When, what do we do on top of that? We give them just the opposite of story. We, in our arrogance, and in our gaiva, and in our naivete, we think that we did all the work, and now for our kids it's just play. Baba Mises, yeah, we did hard work. And yes, Rabban Cutler is the hero of the 20th century for going up against all odds and planting Torah in America. It's all true. But even after Torah is planted in America, the Sultan also planted his seeds here as well. And our children have to fight different battles, more subtle ones. And they need chizuk in their war of maintaining and sustaining Torah in America. Reb Aaron put down the down payment on Torah in America. And now it's up to our children to carry the mortgage. And anybody who owns a house knows which is more difficult. Yeah, you don't have to come up with $50,000, $100,000 in one shot. But day after day, month after month, our children are being sent a bill. And they have to live through this. And we don't give them credit for that. And they know it. And they become confused because of it. sometimes we confuse our children in another way. Again, this is a well-intended type of confusion, but it's confusion nonetheless. I was once approached by a principal of a girls' seminary. He wanted to know information about a certain girl from my neighborhood, in Far Rockaway where I live. I wanted information because what happened was that this girl went for an entrance examination to the seminary, and I forgot the question that they asked her, something about either movies or Bobby Sox or something like that. And the girl answered, "Well, I think that everybody should do the way they were brought up," or something to that effect. And the menahel of the seminary just wanted to make sure that that statement, which could be interpreted in many ways, didn't mean the wrong way. So he asked me what I know about this girl's frumkeit. So I said, "I want to ask you something, Rabbi so-and-so." I said, "You live in Brooklyn, that's very wonderful. We live out in Far Rockaway, where your daughter can have a neighbor that grows up and goes to the movies and has friends who are boys and wear short sleeves in an Orthodox family. Okay? And your child comes home and says, 'Why can she wear Bobby socks and I can't? Or why can she have short sleeves and I can't? Or why can she have a television and I can't?'" A kid comes home and asks you that. I said, "Seminary principal, what would you tell her?" It was a good question, no? So a seminary principal tells me, "I would tell her, it's like a Brooks. We're not allowed to do it. They have their business, we have our business, but you can't do it." So I said, "You know what? Now you understand the answer the girl gave you by the interview. What did she say? Everybody should do their thing the way they were brought up. That's exactly what you said you would tell her." So she's spitting back at you. What you said is the proper approach to tell her to be mechanech her. But the truth of the matter is, it's not. It's confusing. And it's good to get you off the hook, because what are you going to say? The girl next door is a shiksa. The parents next door are doing wrong. The rabbi across the street doesn't know what he's talking about. What are you going to tell this girl? So you don't want to say any of those things. And I don't blame you for not wanting to say any of those things. So you tell her this. However, the price that you pay is that when this girl grows up, she may say, "You know what? I want to marry somebody that eats gebrots. Except instead of gebrots, it's going to be the movies, and it's going to be the television, and it's going to be all those things that you don't want her to do, but you taught her all her life that it's just Nusach Svard and Nusach Ashkenaz. And if your daughter would marry somebody who's Nusach Svard, big deal." Or if, let's say, I remember I grew up in yeshiva, I went to Chaim Berlin, I had a bacher in my, who's one class above me, who decided he wants to become a Satmar Chassid. Wants to be a Satmar Chassid. So he became a Satmar Chassid. Satmar Chassid. Now the parents, at the beginning at least, they were shocked, they weren't too thrilled about that. Now Baruch Hashem, they're very happy with him, he's a fine Ben Tzvi and everything's wonderful. It's what, 20 years later? But it wouldn't have been the same reaction from the parents if the guy decided he wanted to be a Jew for Yoshka, or if he wanted to be conservative, or if he wanted to go mixed swimming camp in the summer. It's different reactions. But now what happens to your child if all your life you tell her that the neighbor that goes mixed swimming in the summer, that goes to the beach, that's a different nusach, that's a different mahalach, that's not our approach, and then the girl grows up and says, "You know, I feel more cut out for that approach. It's two different approaches. I want to daven nusach svard." What are you going to tell her? "That's our minhag, you can't break it." She won't buy it. You lied to her. You sowed the seeds of dissent in her, and now she grows up, and what do you want? You confused her all her life. I'm not telling anybody here I'm nobody to tell anybody, and even if I would, who's interested in what I have to say about it, about what your standards are of Frumkeit when you bring up your kids. However, whatever your standards of Frumkeit are, you make whatever you believe in, you tell your children, this is right and this is wrong. You tell them. If this is just a minig that you do, tell them this is just a minig. If this is what you hold as the din, you tell them this is the din. If this is what you do because you hold it to das Torah, you explain it to them. If this is what you do because you hold it to siyog and a geder, you tell it to them. Don't confuse them. Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky has a little pamphlet to say from Pirkei Avos, and on the Mishnah Loi Habayshin Loi Meid, excuse me, Loi Amoharetz Chosid. He asked, why Loi Amoharetz Chosid? Why can't an ignoramus be a Chosid? They'll always go lachumra. Why not? So Rav Yaakov says that Loi Amoharetz Chosid doesn't mean mutter or osur. You have to know what's a minig, what's a halacha, what's chayvei krisus, what's right, what's wrong, what levels it is, because there are a lot of nafkaninas. And I'm telling you one not from a halachic point of view, I'm telling you one from a chinuch point of view. Don't confuse your children. Tell them, look, the rabbi next door says, a lady from shul called me. Says everybody in the neighborhood is going to this pool. Frum lady, the lifeguard's a man. Can I go? I told you you can't go. That's what I hold. Treifkeit that are in the movies nowadays, you just add, multiply that to the thousandth power. You tell that to your children. The girl next door does it. Say, well, the girl next door is doing wrong. Now, does that mean that you should throw rocks at her and call her shiksa? No. Why? Because somebody does something wrong doesn't mean you have to throw rocks at them and call them shiksa. We seem to have this black or white mentality that either we throw rocks at the next door neighbor or we can't explain to our children that they're doing something wrong. What's wrong with the truth? What's the MS? The MS is yeah, they are wrong. And the MS is no, you should not throw rocks. What is so difficult with explaining that? Why can't we do it? It's the truth. A girl showed me an essay she wrote in school. She wants to print it somewhere. About how she feels that because she violates this rule of school and that rule of school, they look down on her and call her a bum and this and that. Now, if she's violating rules, she deserves to know that she's violating rules. She's violating rules. Wrong is wrong and right is right, period. There's rules of the school, there's rules of the Torah, there's rules of your parents, there's rules. But to make it so black and white, that therefore, since you violated this rule, therefore, you are hopeless, therefore, you are no longer white, you are now black. It's not true. It's not the MS. Why should we say a sheker? Somebody does wrong, it's wrong. And you don't want your children associating with that bad influence. But there's a difference between disassociation and rock throwing. What I'm saying is that this dilemma that we have of trying to explain to our children that what the neighbors are doing are below our standards is not really a dilemma. Because all you have to do is trust in the truth and tell them the truth. But we confuse our children. And again, I could say the same principle in a conservative shul. Because it has nothing to do with what standards you should have. What I'm saying is whatever standards you hold from and you believe them, that's what you should be teaching your children. Whatever you hold is right, you tell them is right. Whatever you hold is wrong, you tell them is wrong. Whatever you're misupik about, you don't know, you can tell them, I don't know. I have to ask the Rav. I don't know. What's wrong with that? In the Shulchan Aruch sometimes it says, according to the Rambam's Shita, are you allowed to move a telescope, an astrolabe on Shabbos? Shulchan Aruch says, well, according to the Rashba, you're allowed to. According to the Rambam, I don't know. Yeshul his topic. I don't know. What's wrong with Shulchan Aruch Paskins? I don't know. If you don't know, you say you don't know. If you do know, say you do know. What's so hard about that? And there's nothing wrong with saying you don't know. That's the next thing. Parents sometimes feel that they're going to lose respect in the eyes of the children if they say, I don't know. I'll have you know an observation that I've noticed. That there are those parents that will say, I don't know. And those parents, those fathers particularly, are the Talmidei Chachamim, relative to the ones that won't say, I don't know, that are less knowledgeable in Torah. Because the ones that are knowledgeable have the self-confidence to be able to tell a child, good question, let's look it up. And he'll pull out a Shulchan Aruch, and he'll look it up, and he'll learn with the kid. And he will show the kid what to do. You are teaching your child something. What to do when you don't know. If you tell your child you do know when you don't, you are teaching him. You think you're fooling him. You're not. You're teaching him that when you don't know, put on a good face. Make something up. There's nothing wrong with teaching a child that we always have to learn Torah. And one principle of learning Torah is that you learn because you don't know. You chazer because you know, but you learn because you don't know. And you tell a child, I don't know, let me ask the Rav. And you know something, sometimes your children will come to you and they're going to want something. And you're mistupik if you should do it. Your teenage son will come, he wants to go on vacation to California for a week with his friends. And you're not so sure. Your daughter's going to come over to you and she says she wants to go to this and this camp with her friends. And you're not so sure. And there's nothing wrong with telling your son or your daughter, look, I don't know. This is what I'm worried about. But on the other hand, I may be wrong because of this and this reason. You want to go to Los Angeles for a week vacation. What's going to be with learning? It really is a temptation to dreza charuma whole day and minyan, davening. What's going to be? What kind of elements are you going to be with? They really are bad influences. It really is not something that I would like you to be involved with. On the other hand, I trust you. You're a wonderful boy. You want to have some fun. Can I tell you that I'm choshe, I suspect you're going to do something wrong? I'm not sure exactly what I should do. Let's ask a Rav. Let's discuss it. Something like, what's wrong with that? Are you scared that you're going to get the different answer than what you want? That's a no-no. You cannot ask a shayla because you don't want an answer. You find somebody you trust, you teach your child that in life there are going to be dilemmas. Small dilemmas, big dilemmas. Who doesn't have dilemmas? The biggest Rabbanim have dilemmas. I told you Shulchan Aruch had dilemmas. No matter how much talent you have for being a definitive Torah authority, you're not going to know everything. And so, what do you do when you're in a dilemma? Do you do what you want? Do you do what your friends want? Do you just follow momentum? Or do you try to find out what the right thing is and do it, even if that's not what you want? And you tell your child, you know, I want to do the right thing. I want to let you have the fun, but I don't want to do something that I feel may hurt you. And I'm not sure about this. What's wrong with saying that? I'm not sure, so let me find out. Let me discuss it with somebody. Maybe you can help me. You can tell me, put my mind at rest. Do you have any information for me that can help? You'd be surprised. Happens to be there certain things that kids want to do that automatically turns up a red flag in parents' minds that are really nothing, and things that they want to do that seem like nothing that are really dangerous. For some reason, I found that when children mention the name of the borough Manhattan, parents get all scared. If a kid says, "I want to go to Manhattan with my friends these evenings to this and this and this," Manhattan. Manhattan, it automatically, all sorts of dangerous visions dance around in your head. It may or may not apply to you, but I know more than one, two, three, or four parents that it does apply to. Do you know where this friend, do you know where this guy took my daughter last week? This girl, they went to Manhattan. They spent the evening. What are they doing over there? I don't know. Brooklyn's bad enough. That's nothing. Don't do that. And Manhattan is just an example. An example of whatever your first impression is, it may or may not be true. To go to the corner grocery store may be more detrimental to your child's spiritual and physical well-being than to spend an evening in Manhattan in some sporting place. Listen. That's rule number one. Listen to your child and see what he says. Tell me about this Los Angeles trip. Where are you going to be? Tell me about this place. Why does it? Give me the information. Show them that you want to do what's best for him. Ultimately, the decision is yours. Ultimately, the decision is yours. Nobody can take that away from you. But you have to show them that you're trying to do the right thing. And if they think you're trying to do the right thing, you just gained a big fringe benefit. You know what that is? They're going to listen to you. 9 out of 10 times, they'll listen to you. If the 10th time they won't listen to you, fine. That's where discipline comes in. But 9 out of 10 times, they'll listen. If they feel they're getting a fair deal. Because I could tell you that the reason why kids don't listen more often than not, and I'm not talking about 6-year-olds, I'm talking about 16-year-olds, because they think the parents either don't understand, wouldn't understand, don't know what's going on, and they do it. There are X amount of times where the Yetzer Hara just tells them have fun rather than do the right thing. But even then, there's always a piss and pair, there's always an excuse that they have, that my parents don't really understand. The way, the antithesis of this problem is understand and show them you understand. And you may be thinking, why should I have to lower myself and show my kids that I understand? The answer is you don't. Don't come crying to me when your kids don't listen. This is the way kids are. This is the way the nature is. This is the way HaKadosh Baruch Hu made the Teva. Children, teenagers need to know that their parents understand what's going on. And I don't mean what's going on in the world. I mean when a parent makes a decision, a child needs to know, needs to feel comfortable that the parent is making a fair decision. And there's no reason why not to make a fair decision. Sometimes you're going to be letting your children do things that are against your, not better judgment, but against the better judgment of your kishkas. I remember when I was 17 years old, my parents got me a car. For whatever reason. You know how many calls they made to the police when I didn't show up here or I was missing there, or they thought this and that. For whatever reason, in their best judgment, this was the right thing to do. But it still made them nervous, as nervous as could be. It's not a stira. You gotta be fair. And you got to make your kids understand you're being fair. Sometimes you say no, but a fair no. And sometimes you say yes, even if it's against your kishkas. You know why? Because you want to teach your children that they should do what's right, even if their feelings are different. If it says in the Torah, if it says in the Shulchan Aruch, this is what you have to do. We can't allow our children to say, well, I feel this is right. And we know that's done so many times by children and adults. So we cannot show them any different on our part. We have to show them that we do what's right, even if we feel differently. And you can say, look, I don't feel good about this. It's okay. That's just my kishkas talking. I know this is right and this is fair. Do me a favor. Call home from Los Angeles every day. Try your best, please. Something like that. It's just a mashal. I'm not telling you to send them to Los Angeles. Just a mashal. That's the bottom line. In short, in summary, confused kids are the most vulnerable to the Yetzer Hara. It doesn't mean a kid that has a doubt. Having a doubt and being confused are two different things. Having a doubt means you don't know. Being confused means you know two things that are contradictory. There's a big difference than having a contradiction in your heart as opposed to having a doubt in your heart. Confused children are the most vulnerable to the Yetzer Hara. Children with doubts are your greatest opportunity to mold. Confused children are in the greatest, gravest danger. Therefore, we have to make sure not to bring up confused children. How do we do that? A, be clear to them what your policies are regarding right and wrong. Be clear to them what your policies are about what's doing in your heart, about what's right and wrong for them. Be clear to them about your own uncertainties, if you're uncertain. Be clear to them about everything. Trust the MS. The MS is the strongest weapon that Klal Yisrael has for any. Nothing can stand against the MS. The Kutzker Rebbe once said about the Medrash when Hashem created the world. He said all the Malachim came to him and voted. And Chesed said, make man, because he's a big Baal Chesed. Sholem said, don't make man, because he's Kulei Ketata, he's a big Baal Machloikis. Emes said, don't make man, because he's Kulei Sheker. And after the votes were tallied, the side that said, don't make man, won by one. Hishlech Emes Artsa, Hashem threw Emes out, and he created man. And the Kutzker Rebbe said, why did he have to throw Emes out? Why couldn't he throw Sholem out? So the Kutzker Rebbe said, because as long as MS says something, even if there's a majority on the other side, the MS wins. If you want to take a vote, that's only without MS. If there's MS there, nothing can stand in its way. We, in our desire to be machanech our children the right way, very often sacrifice the MS. And I'm not saying everything should be told to everybody, but we err on the side that we shouldn't. We very, very often err on the side of not telling them, not revealing to them things that we should. Because they have to see us the way we live, and the way we live, that's the way they're going to live. If we live through sheker and through manipulation, and through fear and confusion, that's the way they're going to grow up. If we live through the truth and through self-sacrifice and through the desire to do what's right no matter what the cost, and we show that to them, and fairness and yashrus, that's how they're going to grow up. And now I'm going to, as is customary by the Vishur, I'm going to take questions on any topic at all. The ladies have a minute to write down the questions on a piece of paper and hand them up. Okay, the questions are coming. In the meantime, is there anything from this side? Okay. Please make them short and sweet as much as you can. Yes.
In the first year,
yeah,
you said that while we're teaching Torah in the year of 40, we're up against the visual in today's society. At the same time, you said we can't compete with the visual, because if we make dancing out of phase, when the Bokra gets a little bit older, he's going to look for the out of phase to dance off the page. That's not going to do it. What can we do visually?
Okay, question. There's a question about the first shiur, really. And that is, during the first shiur I discussed about how we are outgunned when we try to teach our children right from wrong, because we are using intellectual teaching methods, and the Sutton is using flashy advertising Madison Avenue methods. Ain't a dime is shmiel or ri'ya. We're using shmiel, they're using ri'ya. How do we combat it? In Yirtzeh Hashem, this is the topic of the next year. Okay? The next year, thank you. Yirtzeh Hashem, you may as well, Henry, you'll announce it afterwards, okay? This will be the topic of the next year. How to combat the flashy ammunition and the sensory overload that our children are getting from the side of the Yetzer Hara. How we could really hit them over the head with what's right, not just explain it to them. You know, you explain something to your kid, this, let's go to the movies. And then they go out and they see these big posters and these big flashy signs and these big taivas, they're assaulted from all directions. We use shmir, they use ri'ya. How do we fight that? That's for the next year, Yirtzeh Hashem. What to do with a constantly moody child? What to do with a constantly moody child? It depends on a lot of variables that I don't have on the paper, and it's beyond the scope of this particular question. Therefore, I would suggest that you call me, we'll make an appointment, we'll talk, you can tell me about the moody child, and if I can help you, I gladly will. But this is not a question for Al Regalachas. Hillel could do it Al Regalachas. I can't. With what goes on during the summer months in the mountains, should we allow our children to go off campgrounds on days off? What safeguards should we give them if your answer is yes? The answer is they should only go off campgrounds if they're supervised by someone who you trust. Even teenagers are counseled. There has to be somebody on the administration side that will be a supervisor. What? If it doesn't work that way, I don't know. When we were kids, we always had that rule. Somebody has to be accountable. Where did you go? What did you do? If it doesn't work that way, then the answer has to be no. I have to say no. You can't, unless you trust the kids themselves. If you tell me you don't trust the supervisors, then how could you trust the kids? What should I tell? If you tell me that the supervisors aren't trustworthy, so you tell me about the kids. I would have to say no, unless you know you have a way to control where the kids are and what they're doing. Drop them off and pick them up at a certain time, in a spot in a place where they can't get into too much trouble. Well, there has to be somebody there to record responsible, to report. Somebody honest. There's nobody honest in the whole camp. Then I can't say yes. I can't say yes. If there's nobody to be trusted, what can you do? Send a counselor with them. The counselors also can't be trusted. You're talking about counselors. If the people will still apply for the jobs and you'll be able to run your camp this way, I would say no, don't let them off. If you don't have a staff, then business is business. What should I tell you? What can I tell you? But it'll only work if all the camps do this together. I don't know what the camp's policies are, but if one camp decides to do it, then everybody will go to the next camp. It'll only work if they do this together. If MS is a desirable feature in this world, why do we attribute Olam MS to the afterworld with them rather than to our own? Is this rhetorical? Olam HaMS means that despite our best efforts to attain the midah of MS in this world, there's always a lot of sheker here, whether we like it or not. But that doesn't mean we shouldn't try. In the next world, it's all MS. Somebody once came to the Satmar Rebbe, and it was Reb Moshe's son-in-law. Reb Moshe once had a son-in-law who was a very chosher of a yid, Gatzal. Reb Shitzgal, his name was. He's not alive. And he went to the Satmar Rebbe once, and he asked the Satmar Rebbe a question. He said, it says in Pirkei Avos, Al Shlosh and Dvarim Hoylem Kayim, on three things the world is maintained. Al HaMS is one of them. So he said that everybody says, this guy's a liar, and this guy lied, and this was a sheker, and that's a sheker, so how does the world stand? So the Satmar Rebbe said, you know what? All that stuff, that's all true. This guy lied, and that guy lied, and that guy, that's all MS. But the truth is this. It's an assignment in this world to recognize the sheker. This is what the Satmar Rebbe really meant. Recognizing the sheker is also MS. There's some people that have sheker and they think it's MS. And some people encounter sheker and they know it's sheker. You're right, we don't live in an olam ha-MS. We live in an olam of sheker. And our job here is at least to recognize Sheker for what it is. That we can do. In the next world, we won't have to do that because it's Olam HaEmes. But that's what we can do, at least in this world. Okay, it's getting late, I'll be short. Even though Avuya did not have the best of intentions for wanting his son to learn Torah, why was he punished that his son, who even got the title in the Gemara of being called Acher, became an Apikiris? Doesn't Maimer Chazal below hold? The Olam Yasek Adam Torah Mitzvah Apil Shalosh Moshe Mitzvah Shalosh Ma'abel Shmoh. Yeah. Two things. First of all, if we're going to learn that the Gemara means that Avuya was punished, that's not how we were learning this evening. This evening we were learning that it was just an imperfection that Elisha acquired. But if you're going to learn that he was punished, it's because of his high madrega. Different tzaddikim are punished for different things, all according to your madrega. If you're a very big tzaddik, you're punished even for small aveiros. That's the easiest answer. However, it's also true that you only are supposed to learn Torah Shelo Lishma at the beginning. Eventually, after a certain level, you're expected to be learning Lishma. And even when you learn Shelo Lishma, you're expected to learn Shelo Lishma in order later to come to Lishma. Avuya, in short, no matter what approach we're going to take, more was expected of him, for whatever reason. And so he was punished. However, you don't have to learn that way. We're learning today wasn't a punishment. It wasn't, if a father, let's say, is sick, a mother smokes when she's pregnant, her father does something to endanger, a mother does something to endanger the child, the fact that the child acquires the sickness is not a punishment on the mother's part. It's not a punishment that the mother smokes cigarettes, that the child gets sick, Rahman al-Islam. Of course, if the mother deserves, it's a punishment for the mother. But it's not just that. It's a more direct punishment than normal punishment. The mother did this, and therefore the child suffers. If you hit your children over the head, they'll suffer. The fact that they suffer is more than just the punishment. It was more than just the punishment by Avuya. He hit his child over the head. He directly damaged him by having this attitude. And we don't even need, even if you're an Apikoros and you don't believe in Tzchar V'Oinish, for instance, Elisha would still have become an Apikoros, even without the principles of reward and punishment, because Avuya directly damaged his son. If nothing else, we'll close in Davin Meir. Yes. The next year, we're going to announce, is going to be again... Baruch HaMaboyim, welcome everyone to the third in a series of Shiurim on dealing with your teenage children. Until now we spoke about assessing the problem and why nowadays there's more of a difficulty in raising children than there was in the past. We're going to speak more about that in a moment because it catches us off guard. The second shiur we spoke about instilling self-esteem in a child and how we're supposed to train a child to react to his own imperfections. This one, this evening, we're going to learn how to be a role model for your children. And contrary to popular belief, it's not enough just to play the role. While it's true that the do as I see and not as I do parent has no chance of bringing up a normal, healthy child, it's not good enough just to do what you want your child to do. There's a lot more to it than that. And this we get from a Gemara. The Gemara tells us a story about a child that went off the derech in ancient times. The child's name was Elisha. And he was destined to become a very big Gadol Hador. He learned Torah from Rabbi Meir, who was one of the great Tanoim of his days. This Elisha, who was supposed to be such a great Talmud Chacham, ended up driving a horse on Yom Kippur that came out on Shabbos, right by the Beis HaMikdash, by the Kodesh HaKadoshim. You can't get much worse than that. It was Yom Kippur, and Shabbos, and Yerushalayim, and the Beis HaMikdash, and the Kodesh HaKadoshim. And he rode his horse. Paskoil came out, because this Mechalel Shabbos was still on the Madrega to hear a Baskoil. And that shows you what level of Tumah there had to be in him in order to rip him away from that level of Kedusha. And the Tumah and the Kedusha were still struggling within him. And the Baskoil said, Shuvu Banim Shoivavim. It said, return my backsliding children. Chutz mi Elisha. Except for Elisha. The Baskoil rejected his tshuva. And it told him, we don't want you anymore. Now, why exactly the Baskoil was justified in throwing up a wall between Elisha and his tshuva is not for tonight. How we reconcile this with the Chazal that tell us Ein lecha davar ha'emid b'fnei ha'tshuva, that there's nothing that stands in the way of tshuva, is not this evening's topic. But the point is that this great man went very, very far off the derech. And it behooves us to try to understand what would schlep such a high-level personality, a man that hears bus coils even as he's being Mechalel Shabbos, what would pull him so far away from that level that he was destined to be on? What is so powerful in the world? What koyach hatuma is so powerful to schlep somebody off the derech so far? And we can imagine that if it schleps Elisha off the derech, it could wreak havoc with any of our children. Rachmon al Islam. Now the Gemara contradicts itself on this. There is a seeming stira in the Gemara as to why Elisha went off the derech. One Gemara tells us that it's his father's fault. His father, a man by the name of Abuya, was also on a relatively high madrega, such that when he saw at Elisha's bris the Talmidei Chachamim learning Torah, and he was able to sense the Malachim learning and the Koilos Dubrokim, and he saw Dvorim Smeichim Kinesinosan Misinai, and we understand that if Abuya was on the level to see Dvorim Smeichim Kinesinosan Misinai, he was not a simple person. We are not dealing with simple people over here. We are dealing with people on very, very high madrigas. And this Elisha, this Abuya, this father of this 8-day-old child Elisha, decided right then and there to dedicate his son, his newborn 8-day-old Elisha, to Torah for the rest of his life. And he said, if this is the glory that Torah brings, this Dvom Smechem Kinesinasa Misinai, if this is how magnificent Torah is, and he was able to sense on his high madrega all the great magnificence of Torah, then I am going to dedicate my child to it for the rest of his life. And on that day, he decided that this little baby is going to grow up to be a big goyin and tzaddik in Gadol Hadar. Now, we may think that Elisha's resolution, that Abuya's resolution then and there was a very meritorious one, and that he gets credit in a big yashikoyah for dedicating his child to Torah. But the Gemara says no, and it's because more was expected of this man Abuya. The problem was that you should not need to see glory and magnificence to dedicate your child to Torah. Abuya was dedicating his son to Torah for shaloi lishma reasons. If he wouldn't have seen those glory, if he wouldn't have seen the fireworks, he would not have dedicated his son to Torah? The answer is he wouldn't have. And therefore, if it's only fireworks that are...